Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Memories are subjective. We all see the same sights, we all hear the same sounds, and we all smell the same smells. But burdened by a limited capacity, our minds only remember the smallest of fragments, all of which are distorted by time, bias, emotion, and trauma. The simplest of details may imperceptibly change. Colors, shapes, sizes, names, dates, times, and even locations, to the point where two people sitting side by side in the same room at the same time may see the same event in a radically different way as their brains edit that brief moment to suit their own perspective. Unconsciously, we all do it. And yet, we all believe that our memories are real. In 1943, just 2 miles west, and less than 1 year after the horror of the Blackout Ripper, a second serial sexual sadist stalked the bomb-damaged streets of London. Strangely, they were both in uniforms. They both struck during the blackout, and they both appeared as kind, pleasant, and caring. But unlike the Blackout Ripper, whose insatiable lust for sex and death left 4 women dead and 2 lucky to be alive, this serial killer was older, wiser, and calmer. Seen as an upstanding pillar of society, a happily married man, and a decorated war hero who lived locally at 10 Rillington Place. Although he was known as Mr. Christie, to those he liked, he preferred they call him Reg. And yet, in a reign of terror, which would last not a few days, but a whole decade, 8 women would disappear, 1 man would be executed, and no one would suspect him. You may think you know this story, as many variations of it have been told, but with much of the evidence destroyed, there is no definitive account of what happened. Some of what follows is based on the killer's own memories and perspective. So what part of this story is true is up to you. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide. This is Murder Mile. And I present to you part 1 of the full, true, and untold story of the other side of 10 Rillington Place. Today, I'm standing at 110A Ladbroke Grove, at the farthest fringes of London's West End, 3 miles west of Soho, 1 mile north of Hyde Park, and within spitting distance of Portobello Road, Notting Hill, and that infamous blue front door owned by the film's writer, who subsequently, following the film's success, sold the house for oodles of cash. Clever man. Now called the Flowered Corner, 110A Ladbroke Grove is a four-story brown brick Victorian terraced house, nestled on the northeast corner of the crossroads of Lancaster Road and Ladbroke Grove. With three flats above, the ground floor is a floristry shop, a single bright spot on a dirty, dusty street, where the sweet smell of nectar is strangled by the greasy stench of chicken shops. The soothing colours of tulips are smothered by the choking fumes of trucks, buses and tube trains, and the harmonious tranquility of fresh pansies was once, as witnessed by myself, sullied by a rather displeased youth cussing from a beaten-up banger. With his music blaring, no lights on, and no windscreen, who was smoking a spliff, wearing a Fuck the Police t-shirt, and bemoaning two straight-faced coppers by complaining,
"Why are you police always hassling me?"
Back in the 1940s, 110A Ladbroke Grove was known as David Griffin's Refreshment Room, a simple cafe serving standard British staples like tea, coffee, toast, and fry-ups, for a reasonable price in a poverty-stricken area. And yet, it was here, on the 21st of August 1943, that a 21-year-old girl called Ruth First, who had already escaped her certain death, would meet her new murderer. Ruth Marguerite Christina First was born on the 2nd of August 1922, the second of three children to Ludwig, an Austrian landscape painter, and Frederica, a Jewish housewife, with an older brother, Gottfried, and a younger brother, Gabriel. Raised in the middle-class affluence of Zurich, Switzerland's largest city, Ruth's upbringing was peaceful, happy, and joyous. And being a well-educated girl from a very liberal and unpolitical family, she embraced her life, her rights, and her freedom. Eager to become a nurse, although a little bit shy, Ruth was always studious, intelligent, and patient. Having inherited her father's slim, awkward frame, being a few inches taller than most girls, she always stood out. And as a fastidiously neat girl, with pale but easily flushed skin, brown but eternally sad eyes, and a neat bob of dark straight hair, a colouring passed down from her mother's Hungarian ancestry. Although Ruth looked typically Jewish, she wasn't. Plagued with minor complaints from birth, like a hereditary blood disorder, which often left her weak, buckled knees, which kept her excluded from sports, and terrible teeth, which left her in chronic pain, as a beloved girl from a well-to-do family, able to afford doctors, medicine, and fortuitously, a metal crown fitted to her upper right molar, life could have been a lot worse. In need of fresh air, good light, and striking landscapes to paint, her father Ludwig moved the family to a spacious villa on the edge of a forest, in the picturesque Austrian spa town of Bad Vöslau, famed for its lush vineyards and rolling hills, 23 miles southwest of his hometown of Vienna. Being surrounded by her family, Ruth was happy, safe, and loved. And although this affluent and bustling market town was home to just over 9,000 people, by the late 1930s, many homes would become vacant, many people would vanish, and for the first time in its history, the population of Bad Vöslau would rapidly shrink. On the 15th of September 1935, with the National Socialist German Workers' Party having risen to power, fueled by rabid anti-Semitism, the Reichstag established the Nuremberg Laws. Its purpose? To create an Aryan state and eradicate anyone who wasn't pure blood, whether black, gay, Romani, disabled, or Jewish. The Nazis classified a Jew as anyone who practiced Judaism, identified as Jewish, had married a Jew, and regardless of whether they were a practicing Roman Catholic, as many German Jews had been since the 19th century. If any person had traceable Jewish ancestry, they were subject to the Nuremberg laws and regarded as a Mischling, or half-blood. For the next 2 years, with all five members of the first family being Mischlings, they were all denied any rights, freedoms, and being treated as an Untermensch, German for subhuman. Ruth and her family were forced to undertake menial and demeaning jobs, one of which included scrubbing road surfaces with acid, which left Ruth's palms badly scarred forever. On the 12th of March 1938, as the Nazis annexed Austria, all Jewish-owned properties were seized, all personal belongings were sold, and having been forcibly separated, the fate of the first family was unknown. Some hid, others fled, and whereas the rest were rounded up and transported to uncertain fates. For the first time ever, Ruth was alone, homeless, and scared. She was just 16 years old. From the 1st of October 1938, for 8 months, Ruth hid in the basement room at Nummer 2 Nestroplatz in Nazi-controlled Vienna, never knowing if her family were alive or dead. With fate smiling upon her, Ruth was issued with a passport, and on the 8th of June 1939, just 3 months before the start of World War II, being hungry and exhausted, Ruth fled to England. And yet, having escaped the horrors of the Nazi regime, a life of poverty, persecution, and her certain execution, it was here, in the safety of West London, that Ruth first would end up dead.
She were Austrian, I believe. A nice girl, plain but sad-looking. I met her in the summer of 43, in a cafe in Ladbrook Grove. Got herself into a dreadful mess she had. Awful. So I gave her a few shillings, you know, to help her along. That's all. It seemed like the right thing to do.
And that consequently, this country is at war with Germany.
On the 1st of September 1939, Britain declared war on Germany. A brutal 6-year conflict which left homes decimated, families displaced, countless casualties maimed, crippled, and traumatized. And by the end of it all, at least 11 million people would be dead. One of whom was Ruth. Having just turned 17, Ruth was still a child. An impressionable young girl from a foreign land, who was scared and lost in a big strange city. With a limited grasp of English, a patchy education, weak legs, bad blood and sore teeth. With no skills, no friends and no family. And although she was thankful to be safe, missing her mother's hug and her father's love, she was alive, but also so alone. The last 4 years of her life were solitary and chaotic. And as much as she strived, she struggled. Initially, she lived with her guarantor, Miss Edith Bessie Willis, in a delightful white terraced cottage at 92 Oakwood Road, in the very Jewish northwest London neighbourhood of Golders Green. But with Edith being a prim and proper lady, and Ruth being a distraught teenager, with scars on her hands, an emptiness in her heart, and unimaginable horrors still plaguing her mind. They never got on. Still seeking to fulfill her dreams, Ruth enrolled as a student nurse at St. Gabriel's Home in the seaside town of Westgate-on-Sea. And upon graduation, with a bright career in her sights, Ruth found work at the Santa Claus Children's Home in Highgate. And life had hope. And then, as an Austrian exile who had legally entered England, even though she was just a young girl, being unsure whether she was a Nazi sympathiser, Ruth's newly adopted country had her transferred to the Hutchinson internment camp in Douglas. A cold, barren, and inescapable prison on the remote Isle of Man in the middle of the Irish Sea, surrounded by bare walls, locked doors, and barbed wire. 6 months later, having been deemed not a threat by the British government, Ruth regained her freedom. But with her job gone, her reputation ruined, and her life in tatters, with German bombers obliterating every city, Ruth was evacuated from London, and once again, uprooted to the windswept wilds of Elswick in Lancashire, where she knew no one. And still, her life would only get worse. Half a year of enforced captivity had taken its toll. And whereas once this sweet, polite, and joyous girl had been replaced by a fiery, moody mess, with tatty clothes, sullen eyes, and unwashed skin, looking like a ragged orphan, which she knew she most likely was, Ruth had become trapped in a mental fog. With a doctor diagnosing her as severely depressed, although the capital wasn't safe, for the sake of her mental well-being, Ruth was moved back to the familiarity of London. London was a city in ruins. After 8 months of sustained aerial bombardment, having failed to pummel the proud populace into submission, with the Luftwaffe being unrelenting, the bombings continued. An estimated 43,000 civilians would die during the air raids, as with the daily risk of being killed by an incendiary bomb, a doodle bug, or a V1 rocket, to many Londoners, death was a part of life. Houses would vanish overnight, sometimes terraces, and even whole streets, and with its occupants being obliterated by blast waves or incinerated by fire, the only evidence that a family ever existed was when the special constables pulled bodies from the debris, sometimes alive, sometimes dead, sometimes whole, injured, or disfigured. And yet sometimes all that was left was a foot, a hand, or a head. Nasty business it was. But in wartime, it wasn't unheard of for someone to simply vanish. Being eager to rebuild a small semblance of life, having endured rationing, blackouts, and the limitations of her refugee status, Ruth ploughed on, hoping to make something of herself, and God rest them, her parents proud. In December 1941, whilst living in a small but pleasant lodging, studying for her return to nursing, and working as a waitress at the exclusive Mayfair Hotel in Stratton Street, W1, just shy of Piccadilly Circus, Ruth met and fell in love with a Greek Cypriot waiter called Anastasio Isidorin. A few months later, being rosier about the cheeks, full around the hips, and with a noticeable bump, Ruth discovered that she was about to become a mum. And with the little miracle of a baby girl blossoming in her belly, having prayed nightly to the Lord and him finally hearing her cries. He blessed her with one more miracle. Frederica and Ludwig I, her mother and father, weren't dead. Having fled the horrors of the Nazi regime and boarded a boat, her parents were alive, well, and living in the safety of East 57th Street in New York City, where they hoped Ruth would join them. But being heavily pregnant, desperately broke, and very recently single, in her state, Ruth knew that she couldn't. And as fate would have it, she wouldn't. As a young girl with weak legs, bad blood, poor teeth, and frequent bouts of depression, life was hard. As an unskilled and partially educated female in the 1940s, life was harder. As a wartime refugee of Austrian Jewish parentage living in London, life was even harder. But also, being an unmarried, expectant mother of no fixed abode, with no job, money, or immediate family, life was impossible. So on the 9th of October 1942, in the West End Lane Home for Unmarried Mothers in Hampstead, being alone, scared and desperate, Ruth gave birth to a baby girl, who she named Christina. Moments later, her baby was taken away. She never saw her again. From the end of 1942 to the middle of 1943, having moved from job to job, lodging to lodging, leaving a trail of unpaid bills, as she slowly sunk back into depression, Ruth's life returned to chaos. On the 25th of May 1943, Frederica received the last letter that Ruth would ever write. In it, she stated that she was working the night shift in a local munitions factory and reassured her mother that she was fine, well, and she sent her love. On the 29th of June 1943, Ruth quit her job as a machinist at John Balding & Sons, a munitions factory at the back of Bond Street Station. And although she was always tired, tardy, and sickly, barely working 20 hours of her 40-hour week, her co-workers believed that once again she was pregnant. On Saturday the 21st of August 1943, at little after lunchtime, Ruth was seen by her landlady, Julie Theresa Walker, leaving her flat at 41 Oxford Gardens. As she walked one road south towards Ladbroke Grove tube station, wearing a very distinctive, fake leopard skin coat. That was the last confirmed sighting of Ruth I. Believing she'd absconded without paying her rent, her landlady reported her missing 10 days later. As one of many missing refugees, her details appeared in the Police Gazette, but nobody searched for her. And as one of thousands of innocent civilians believed to have been killed during the aerial bombardment, the mystery surrounding her death wouldn't be investigated until a decade later. She were Austrian, I believe. A nice girl. Plain. But sad-looking. But in wartime, it wasn't unheard of for someone to simply vanish. After this moment, only one person witnessed her alive. A special constable working out of the Harrow Road police station, who'd been commended twice by the police commissioner, and as a local man who was moral, teetotal and charitable, was widely regarded as an upstanding pillar of society, a happily married man, and a decorated war hero. The special constable's name was John Reginald Halliday Christie, known as Mr. Christie.
But I prefer it if you call me Reg.
It was Saturday lunchtime. As per usual, although small and snug, David Griffin's refreshment room at 110A Ladbroke Grove was busy. In the corner, Ruth and Reg sat side by side, as they had done several times before. Ruth found it difficult to make friends, but with Reg being so approachable, kind and caring, even though he and his wife Ethel had no children of their own, the word which best described him was fatherly. As a slightly built man, twice her age, but the same height and weight as Ruth, Reg seemed like a harmless sort. And being almost totally bald, except for a thin crown of hair above his ears, wearing thick-lensed horn-rimmed spectacles, which magnified his soft brown eyes, a set of false teeth, which being too big, sometimes slipped when he spoke, and talking in a barely audible whisper, having been injured in a mustard gas attack whilst bravely serving his country during the Great War. Although he looked a little odd, she could see that Reg was a sweet and caring man who wouldn't harm a fly. Ruth and Reg sat together, him having brought her a tea and toast, as he listened to her woes, his hand tenderly touching hers. But it wasn't hard and coarse, but a little limp and damp.
Got herself into a dreadful mess, she had. Awful.
Being 10 days away from failing to pay her rent, once again, Ruth risked eviction. Being unemployed, she couldn't afford a checkup on her weak legs, her bad blood, her chronic teeth, or the new baby, which was probably on the way. And as a deeply moral man, who
never used prostitutes myself,
he'd often turn a blind eye to a good woman who'd fallen on hard times and had struggled to make ends meet.
So I gave her a few shillings, you know, to help her along. That's all. It seemed like the right thing to do.
Having visited his home twice before and kept this special constable company on his beat, on Tuesday the 24th of August 1943, Ruth entered Rillington Place. A grey, featureless dead end, with 10 three-storey Victorian terraced houses on both sides, with no trees, plants or front gardens. And like it was cutting the street dead in its tracks, stood a 10-foot-high brick wall, behind which tube trains thundered by. Keen to collect those 10 shillings, Ruth knocked on the black wooden door of 10 Rillington Place. First to greet her was Judy, Reg's overexcitable brown mongrel. But once again, there was no sign of his wife Ethel, who was up north visiting her family in Halifax. The hallway was thin, drab and dark. To the left was a set of stairs which led up to the other tenants' flats. And to the right was the ground floor flat which belonged to the Christies, with a front room, a bedroom and a kitchen, with a neat little garden and a communal washhouse and lavatory out back. So with tea brewing on the hob, Reg ushered Ruth along the thin hallway into the kitchen. Having no central heating, limited electricity, and illuminated by Victorian gas lights, which bathed the pokey kitchen in a flickering yellow glow, as Reg perched awkwardly in front of the alcove on a small round stool, Ruth leaned back in his one good seat. By good, it was really just a wooden deck chair, draped in a grey blanket and held together by what should have been 6 lengths of rope. But as she sat there, supping a nice cuppa and getting toasty in front of the wood-burning range, Ruth was cosy. For a while they chatted, as the older man imparted his wisdom, knowledge, and fatherly advice to the inexperienced girl. But it was as she stared into his soft brown eyes, longing for love and missing a man's touch, that being overcome with lust, Ruth started to undress.
She was madly in love with me.
Christy was a happily married man. He didn't do this sort of thing. But as she slowly undid the buttons on her fake leopard skin coat, revealing a young slim body with a full heaving bust, being a woman with strong sexual urges, Ruth led Reg into the bedroom.
She was completely naked, lying on my bed, wanting me to have intercourse with her.
And as much as Reg reminded her that he was married,
she wanted us three to team up, to go away somewhere together. I wouldn't do that.
But not wishing to offend her,
I got on the bed and had sex with her.
Of the many statements he gave, all are inconsistent. Sometimes he'd be pedantic about the smallest and most insignificant details.
I don't recall.
And yet, he'd be impossibly vague about whole events.
I can't be certain. It were a while ago, you know.
But when asked where, when, how, and why he murdered Ruth first, he would simply state,
I don't recall.
Except to say,
it were while I was having intercourse with her. I strangled her with a piece of rope.
As the full weight of Reggie's spindly naked body bared down upon her, his putty white legs pressed tightly around her skinny thighs, trapping her legs. Being gripped in panic, fear, and unable to breathe, let alone scream, the more her trembling hands grasped at the taut rope, which slowly crushed her throat, the tighter he pulled it. As her soft youthful skin turned a mottled shade of puce, as the blood vessels in her face swelled and ruptured, as the tightening ligature forced her tongue to jut out of her mouth, like it was trying to escape her silently screaming face, as being in uncontrollable terror, her shaking body expelled its last splash of urine and feces, and as the capillaries in the whites of her eyes began to burst, so they appeared almost black. The last thing that Ruth saw wasn't the sweet smile of her baby daughter, the peaceful fields of her hometown of Bad Vöslau, or Ludwig and Frederica First, her beloved parents, but the terrifying grimace of Reg Christie. As in his hands, he gripped both ends of the straining rope until her life drained away. There she lay, dead.
She looked more beautiful in death than in life. I remember, I gazed down at the still form of my first victim and experienced a strange, peaceful thrill.
But his thrill was to be short-lived. Receiving a telegram that his wife would be home that evening, Reg dragged the naked corpse from the bedroom, along the communal corridor, and into his front room. And under a large rug, where, with a few floorboards loose after a plumber had repaired a leaky pipe, he hid Ruth's body. Ethel arrived home that night, and with fresh sheets on the bed, her brother Henry fast asleep just a few feet away, Reg having burned the clothes in a dustbin and buried the body in the back garden. She was none the wiser of the sex, the death, the body, or her husband, the murderer. And although John Reginald Halliday Christie made several vague statements, when asked in court, "Mr. Christie, was this the first person you had killed?" he would reply,
"I think so. I don't recall."
21-year-old Ruth Marguerite Christina First was just a girl with weak legs, bad blood, and painful teeth, who somehow had escaped persecution, anti-Semitism, and her extermination in a concentration camp at the hands of the Nazis. She'd endured hardship, poverty, hunger, bombings, imprisonment, abandonment, and the loss of her family, her home, her baby, and finally, her life. But being listed as only missing, not dead, and certainly not murdered, Ruth First would become just one of thousands of innocent civilians, believed to have been killed in the wartime bombing raids.
"She were Austrian, I believe. A nice girl, plain, but sad-looking. But in wartime, it wasn't unheard of for someone to simply vanish."
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. If you enjoyed part one, part two of The Other Side of 10 Rillington Place continues next Thursday. Ooh. A huge thank you goes out to my new Patreon supporters, who are literally saving my life by financially keeping Murder Mile afloat with their generous donations, which I definitely don't spend on cake. This week's heroes are Alex Stone and Harriet Oliver. Thank you, guys. May your world be full of Belgian buns, Battenbergs, and fondant fancies. Which for me, that's as good as heaven. Murder Mile was researched, written, and performed by myself, and with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Oh. Okay. Oops. Okay, hello. Right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Extra Mile. It's Michael. Hello. How are you? You good? I'm good. That's good. That is good. 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 Extra Mile time. How are we all? How did you enjoy that? Was that good? That was part one of 10 Rillington, the other side of 10 Rillington Place, the story of, well,
in my version, the story of the victims of John Reginald Halliday Christie. You may know that story, you may not know that story. Even if you do know that story, it doesn't make any difference because this is the other version of it. This is the side that no one tells. Anyway, as I always say every week, if you're new to this podcast, this is Extra Mile. This is the extra bit at the end where I discuss a lot of things that either didn't go into the episode or things, you know, extra context and stuff like that. It's not compulsory. You don't have to hang around if you don't want to, but you can if you want to. People seem to enjoy it. I enjoy it as well because it's relaxing after that first bit takes up almost a whole week to do, not including researching. This bit takes as long. It's just all it takes is as long as it takes me to record it because I don't edit it. And it's refreshing to have that. So, Extra Mile, just so you know, I haven't got a cake in front of me this week. I know, shocking. I'm literally about to move the boat somewhere else, which means I'm moving away from the nice little Jewish neighbourhood that I'm in, which has a really, really nice bakery and does the really, really big Belgian buns. Belgian buns, very nice. So, yeah, I'm going to... Oh, I wonder if I've got time to go and get one before I disappear. I think I might. I think I might have enough time. So... It's always time for cake, isn't there? So, yes. So, no Battenberg today. I'm about to disappear. I've got a coffee on the go here. It's still warm. That's good. So, let's tuck into this episode, part one of 10 Rillington Place. I hope you enjoyed it. I think I did. Oh, before we start, a quick thank you to Kim Nixon. Kim sent me a big box of goodies, which I mentioned last week, but I hadn't received it by the time I'd recorded that. Because obviously these episodes are recorded about 2 weeks in advance. So thank you, Kim, for the goodies. They are now all gone. All of the cakes are gone. I've picked out even the Battenberg, which was in the special Battenberg Life Fest. I know, it arrived in a really, really nice little... It was like a Life Fest. You could throw it into the water and it survived. So it was... Yeah. So I've still got the Life Fest, but all the cakes have gone. Thank you to everyone who has sent me treats. I've got a lot fatter and a lot more wibbly. So, let's crack on. Just to say before we start, you'd notice in there I mentioned that there was a little voice cameo. A friend of mine, Police Constable Arsenal Guinness, the original Police Constable Arsenal Guinness, makes a little voice cameo in there at the start. Around the funny bit of the story, if you go back, you can hear him there. If you fancy a voice cameo in a Murder Mile episode, go to my eShop. It's available on there. There's mugs on there and ebooks and stuff you can buy. But you can also, if someone really loves Murder Mile, God knows who, you can buy a little voice cameo. I'll give you a little line to say. It won't be a big starring role, so you won't be going, oh, I am playing the killer. It'll be like a background artiste in the background. It'll be something that you will notice and you can point out to your friends, and then you'll get your name at the end of the show as the voice cameo. But you can buy that via my eShop if you fancy it. And buying that helps keep Murder Mile afloat as well. So this is going to be a relatively short Extra Mile. Only because I've packed a lot into that episode. I was unsure how much I would be able to get into it. But I really did pack in a lot. And also because this is going to be like an 8-parter. 8 or 9-parter. I still haven't decided whether I'm doing the 9th episode. I might or might not. But... unlike Blackout Ripper, which I really didn't plan, that was kind of freeform. That's why it was started off as a 4-parter, then became a 5 and a 6, then a 10, then an 8. This is definitely an 8. Might be a 9 if I decide to do the extra episode at the end. I haven't decided yet. But I don't want to give too much away, so I'm going to keep this Extra Mile kind of quite slight, really. What am I thinking about? My brain is gone. Okay, so how did I research this? So, obviously, you might know about this case, you might not. This is the story of John Reginald Halliday Christie. Obviously, one of my favourite films in the world is 10 Rillington Place with Richard Attenborough as John Reginald Christie, who's fantastic. John Hurt's in it as well. Really good film. Tim Roth did a version on the BBC with, what's her name? Oh, she's really good. And she played Ethel Christie. Anyway, you can check that out. That's online. Even if you're in America, I think it was on BBC America as well. And it was just called Rillington Place. There's loads of books about John Reginald Christie. But what I wanted to do was to, same with the Blackout Ripper, there was very little written about the victims themselves. Again,
in all of these cases, the victims are kind of footnotes in history. They're kind of ignored. So same as with the Blackout Ripper, I wanted to focus just on the victims and where they came from and their life story. And then we slowly get... obviously, when they get murdered, then you're kind of like, oh, I really feel sorry for them. Whereas, you know, if you just have a story about a killer and he finds someone and he cuts their head off, who cares? Do you know, who cares about the person he's cut their head off? Whereas if you really care about them, do you know, even if they're only just like stabbed in the heart and they slowly die, you just go, you feel sorry for them in, you know, because you miss them already. That's what I try to do with these stories, is make you love and appreciate these people, then miss them. But unlike the Blackout Ripper story, because everyone knows that this is John Reginald Christie, what I wanted to do was, instead of with the Blackout Ripper story where I kind of led you down a path and like he kind of peeps, he appears in episode 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, but you only kind of slightly see him, and then he really appears in 5, and then you learn about his life. Because we already know this is about John Reginald Christie, and it's not difficult to just go online and go type in 10 Rillington Place, it'll pop up with a picture of John Reginald Christie outside his house and his name. So I just thought, let's not monkey around with this. We all know it's John Reginald Christie who's the killer, but let me introduce him slowly through the lives of the victims. So that's what I'm going to do with this. But I'm doing this in a very different way to how I did Blackout Ripper, but also how everyone else tells this story as well. So, obviously for this, obviously I ignored books. I ignored the TV series. I have seen all the TV series and the films, and I've read most of the books, but I've ignored all those because I wanted to go back to source, which I love doing because I hate getting other people's bias when you read the books. So I sat down, I pulled out all of the John Reginald Halliday Christie files from the National Archives, about 30 box files. In total, there's probably about 4,000 pages of transcript. Obviously, I didn't have the luxury of having a year to research it like I did with the Blackout Ripper. I had about 6 weeks. So this was about 12 hours a day, every day, literally just going through every case file. And because it's in no real discernible order, you go through it and you're not too sure what's important. And at that point, I still didn't know what the story was. I didn't know what story I wanted to tell, but I knew it was the victim's story. But I didn't know how to tell John Reginald Christie's story, because it's so famous, it's so well known. So I was going through all the box files, and it was interesting. Sometimes I'd find a detail, and then I'd go, oh, that's interesting. Oh, I like that. And then I'd go, oh, I read something about that somewhere else. And then I'd have to go, shit, what file was it in? And I'd have to reorder the files, and then sit there with files on my desk and think, where in this file do I remember where that one person said about Christie doing this or the victim? Oh, God. So, yeah, it took ages. But so I pieced them all together. And weirdly, by going through all of the court transcripts, there's a lot of court transcripts. There's all of the original witness testimony was there. All the people who knew all the victims, all the people. That was fascinating. But what it did also was, it gave me a different perspective on John Reginald Christie. What it led me into was kind of, I knew that he'd be quite an arrogant man and he would deny stuff, but I had no idea, because they don't talk about this in any of the films or the books or most things like this. They don't talk about the fact that he's very deluded. He lives in his own little world, and he lives in this fantasy world where there's a real perspective where all of these women love him. He's adorable. It's like they can't wait to have sex with him. And he doesn't see the truth at all. So that's what, as soon as I was researching, I thought, that's interesting. I want to try and get across the idea of, from the victim's perspective, we put in as much truth as possible. So I've weeded out a lot of the crap about the victims, which isn't truth. But with John Reginald Christie, I've tried to use a lot of his real words where possible. Obviously, I've had to dramatise some of these as well, because he doesn't talk in clear sentences. But what I've tried to do is get as much of his perspective and his fantasy in there as well, and we try and merge the two worlds together. So really, like I said at the start of this is really about, I'm going to give you all of the evidence, but you need to work out what's real and what's fake, what's fantasy, what exists, what doesn't exist. And for me, it was fascinating going through this. I thought I knew this case really well, and I really didn't. The more I dug deeper into it, the more I was like, learning about Christie and his the way his brain works is just fascinating. It really was. Really, I was just going to do a whole episode really about going back and going flashing back and forth between periods in his past about how they connect to the murders. And I'm doing a little bit of that, but really this is about his mental imbalance, his instability. So I'd researched it that way. I did all the research. It took ages. I put all the research together, but I had no idea how to write it. So this, as always, episode one is the real tough one, because I've no idea how to write it. I don't just sit down and go, right, let's write it. I sit down and go, right, I'm telling the victim's story, but I couldn't work out how to get Christie in there. I couldn't work out how to blend the truth and Christie's fantasy together, because there's big jumping off points. Like, we've got the truth about Ruth's life, and then he meets her in David Griffin's refreshment room, but he may not have met her that day. He may not have met her in David Griffin's refreshment room. He may have met her somewhere else. He may not have met her at all. He says that he met her. She was working as a prostitute in the local area, and he used to, you know, get to know a lot of prostitutes quite well. But there's no real evidence there that she was a prostitute at all. She could have been. There was a lot of ladies around the time who were supplementing their income through prostitution whilst working other jobs, and she wasn't working, so it could be, but was she? We don't know. So how much of this is fantasy, we really don't know. But that's what I wanted to get across, really, was like with the idea that I love the fact that Christie was like, she was so in love with me, and she wanted me to go to bed and, you know, have a three-way with me wife. And it's like, never happened. It almost certainly never happened. Or if she was a prostitute and she had been to his house a couple of times, she could have gone to his house as a prostitute and he paid her those 10 shillings for sex. But in his mind afterwards, he sees it as, she was so in love with me. It's like, I love that. I love that real difference between truth and fantasy. So we're going to have a lot of fun with that. I'm going to try and piece together as much facts as I can about Christie's fantasy, and because there is evidence there, but I'll show you other stories as we go along. So we will return to this kind of story again. There's another one of the murders coming up that I was fascinated by. I thought I knew everything about this, but I'm not going to go into it too much. It's one of the middle episodes, but when they show it in films and TV series and in books and stuff like that, they just focus on it's very straightened down the line, and they show you how they reckon the murder was happened. But Christie's fantasy of the murder, of how he sees it happened, is more interesting than anything else. And I don't know why they always ignore that. It shows Christie's mental inabilities, his lack of capacity. So we're going to have some fun with this. And I've also enjoyed doing the Christie voice as well. You're Austrian, I believe. It's good fun. We don't really have any recordings of Christie's voice itself, but no, I'm not going to tell you about it because that will appear in a later episode. Right. See, it's so much I can't tell you. There wasn't very much about Ruth in the files, which was really annoying, but as you can kind of appreciate, she very much kept herself to herself. She was a refugee. She was a young girl. Her parents weren't here. She was quite secretive and shy. And most of the people who knew her were only interviewed about her life a decade after her death. Because obviously that's only the point when they were like, but prior to that, she was probably killed in a bombing. So it was like, okay, mark her up as killed in a bombing or missing. But when they knew about Christie and they found... I'm not saying anymore. obviously, 10 years later, they had to attribute it as a murder. So therefore they started interviewing people about her life, but obviously things had changed. Like Teresa, her landlady, died in 1950, so she was dead by that point. Many of the people who knew her died in the war or had moved on, or people who were in David Griffin's refreshment room that day How are they going to remember someone who was in a cafe on a day that just merges into all the others a decade prior? So, do you know? So I did what I always did. I went through all the files and I really meticulously went through every single statement to find out just the tiniest details about her life, and then I just pieced them all together. I know you probably think, oh, Michael probably opens up a file and he sees a file that says Ruth first, and it's got all of her details in it, and it's got a whole biography written down. It's not like that at all. It literally is. You have to go searching for her birthday. You have to find her birth certificate. You have to, if someone mentions that her father's called Ludwig, I'll write down Ludwig and go, okay, Ludwig first. And then, do you know, her mother's surname was Altman. It's like, right, it's a very, very, very slow, methodic process of just getting all those details out. But it works. It's, you know what, it was nice because I was able to tell a really good story, I think, about her life and, you know, kind of get across the sadness of it. There's some really, really sad moments in there. It's one of those stories where, do you know, like with Glyndor Michael, where it starts off sad and then it just gets sadder and sadder. And this was one of those ones where it's kind of starts off well, then goes really bad, and then it picks up a bit, and then it goes bad again, and then it picks up again, and then it goes really sad again. And you just go, oh, what a horrible life. It's like, someone, please, just give the poor girl a chance, for God's sake. But obviously that didn't happen. So all of the witness statements are really fascinating, but they're all scattered everywhere, and you've really got to piece through every single detail. And that's the hard thing with a lot of these witness statements, is trying to get a sense of who the person is. Because although it's very useful for people to go, do you know, she was 16 years old and she was brunette with bobbed hair and stuff like that, it's very hard. Very rarely do people actually talk about someone's their personality, their way of thinking. Do you know, it's hard to get across that. But do you know, it was useful here, I think, because she went through real periods of depression, and when you think about her life, you can really kind of get into her mindset very quickly. You know, 16-year-old girl, quite young. She's got medical problems. Thinks her family's dead. Obviously, at present, I don't know about her brothers. I know that her mum and dad made it to New York, but I haven't been able to find anything so far about her brother and sister, her two brothers. Obviously, if I had more time, I would go searching for that, but it doesn't really add to the case. But that's what I love, is digging in and finding these details and really finding out who this person is, rather than just going, on this date, she met this person in this place. What I try to do with this is really, really find out who this person is, who they are deep down in their soul, what their heart is about, what their dreams are, their goals, their ambitions. So you kind of follow their journey in. So when they do get murdered, you kind of feel sorry for them. Or when, like, hopefully with this, when you see that she meets up with Christy, by the time you meet up at that point, you can see that he's the father figure that she kind of needs, and that he's got money, and you know that he's going to kill her. It's interesting with this, it's that because we're only getting this really from Christy's perspective, he said that they were good friends, that they'd meet up very often, for tea, and that she was in need of money, and because he was kind of a father figure, he was going to give her some money. That was his perspective. But whether she actually liked him is unknown. Whether she trusted him is unknown, because don't forget, she was kind of quite a shy person, quite reserved. She didn't really make friends that well. She was quite insular. Whether she really trusted him, we don't know. I mean, if she did meet him whilst he was on his beat, he would have been wearing his police uniform. So, like the Blackout Ripper, as I said before, do you know, kind of people trusted the Blackout Ripper and John Reginald Christie because they were wearing a uniform. It's that kind of thing. You see someone in a uniform and you go, someone I should trust. Policeman, great, perfect. But, and he was known in the area, he was a married man, all of the details that we I'll go into later on. He spends a lot of time talking about his wife. He's obviously got quite a softly spoken voice, northern as well, nice kind of Halifax accent. Probably didn't come across in this episode because I can't really do accents, you know that. But yeah, he was always buying... Like, I've got loads of references. Originally, I started writing these down when I'd find them in the files. And I'd think, so he met this lady called Barbara, let's say, in this cafe, which is not related to a murder. And she's not related to a murder. And you just go, okay, well, what has this got to do with it? But as I was reading it, going through, I was going, ooh, this is quite interesting, actually. It gives a perspective on someone who met with Christie, sat down with him. He bought her cups of tea, listened to her woes. And it was kind of a nice way of hearing what might have happened, what might have been nearer the truth of what happened, as opposed to Christie's perspective. So I've used a lot of those as well. There's a lot of stories of ladies who went back to Christie's flat. There's one that hopefully I'll try and get in, which was... she come round to Christie's. She was a prostitute. Christie had brought her round to the flat. Christie always denied that he used prostitutes, but he did use prostitutes. He'd brought her round to the flat, took her into the bedroom. He took her into the bedroom, not the other way around. He was sitting on the bed with a photo album open with loads of pictures of him and his wife in there, and he spent a lot of time talking about his wife. A lot of this was kind of a distraction thing, because obviously Christie had not just mental problems, he had physical problems as well, which we will go into in greater depth across the episode. But I'll leave that till then. Anyway, as I said before, there are loads of books out there. So if you want, don't feel that you're going to spoil this at all by watching anything or reading anything. If you want, treat yourself. Go and watch 10 Rillington Place. You can either obviously get it on Netflix or something, or someone has very kindly uploaded it to Vimeo. So it's entirely free. But it's a really good film directed by Richard Fleischer, who would later go on to direct another film that I really like, which is The Boston Strangler with Tony Curtis. Not Tony Curtis in a role that you'd expect. He's very good as The Boston Strangler. John Reginald Christie, obviously played by Sir Richard Attenborough, or later Lord Richard Attenborough. Obviously the director of Gandhi, but a fantastic actor in his own right. And John Hurt is in there as well. Interestingly, Richard Fleischer went to Richard Attenborough to get him to play the John Christie role originally. And Christie knew the story, because obviously he's a Londoner as well. He read the script and he was like, I can't do this. I can't play such a horrible man. I just can't do it. Because if you see any interviews with Richard Attenborough, he's the sweetest man in the world. Really is absolute sweet. And he was like, there's no way I can play anyone so evil as this. And then so they started trying to cast around for the role. And he thought to himself, because he is a fantastic actor. If you've seen him in play Pinky in Brighton Rock, he is, oh God, he can play menacing to a treat. And yet he's a sweet man as well. And he was thinking about it. He was thinking about the role and he just thought, you know what? This role has to be done properly. And the problem is, if they get the wrong actor to do it, they could entirely demolish it. It could be entirely ruined. And you have to play a fine line with this role. So go and watch the film. Go and watch his version of John Reginald Christie in the film 10 Rillington Place. It's fantastic. But there won't be any spoilers in there. There's some minor spoilers. You'll see where the story is going. But what I'm trying to do with this is not tell you. I'm going to tell you the story anyway, so it makes no difference. But what you'll do is, you'll say, if you watch the film 10 Rillington Place, you will watch the film and then you'll hear the version I'm doing, which is about Christie's, about what really happened, of which some details in the film they actually changed to make it more film friendly. There were some details that I was shocked by. I was like, I didn't know that didn't exist. But there were other things that I think it's more interesting to see Christie's perspective. So I might even put a link online so you can enjoy the 10 Rillington Place on Vimeo. Or if you've got it on a DVD like I have, just watch it religiously. It's very good. It's very, very good. Anyway, this is going to be an 8-part series here. Not like the BBC and their 3-part series. This is an 8-part series, or it might be a 9-part series. So I hope you enjoy it. Now, obviously, the problem with witness statements when you're going through them is that quite often people can be wrong. And this is what I get with people quite often, where they turn around to me and go, oh, well, I know what happened in this case because I'm related to blah, blah, blah. Or I'm friends of the family with such and such. And they say, well, they know it, what happened. Relatives quite often don't know very much. It's like if you were to turn round to a relative in your family and say, what are the dates of birth of everyone in our family? How many people could get it right? So how can they? And this is what I say with this story is, even two people in the same room can see things in a different way, and that, you know, all of our memories are subjective according to how we decide to translate them. So there's lots of witness statements in there that I was going through, and one that I thought was really interesting. I'll read you a little bit now. I'll read you the pieces. But this was by someone who knew, said they knew Ruth first and knew her husband, Carl, first. Now, I'd written this down because quite a few people in there had said that she'd been married and that Ruth had been married, but sometime during the 1940s, someone doing something horrible outside, it's making a horrible noise, her husband had been killed on the south coast of England in an air raid. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, I didn't know she was married. And I went searching, I couldn't find any marriage certificates or anything like that. Couldn't find anything on Carl first. I knew that she'd had a baby, but you know, there's no details on there at all. So apparently Carl first was 33 years old in 1939. He was about the same age as her. He was a native of Vienna, which I thought, okay, that's fantastic. That's where she was from. They said that Ruth was a daughter of a Viennese doctor, which kind of made me go, okay, well, that's not true because he was a painter, but maybe they just wrote it down wrong, or maybe they didn't know. And then they said, and then she hoped she hoped to become a doctor after finishing her nursing course. I was like, oh, okay, nursing course. Okay, we're back on track. So maybe this is the Ruth. And that they both escaped via Prague, then to England, which actually, from what we could tell, Ruth actually made it through Hamburg, I believe. So that, again, I was like, I'm unsure about that. And then there's all these details about where they stayed in London and all these different places. And then it gets to the end about Carl, that they were living in Maida Vale as well, which is fantastic. She was living in Maida Vale as well. And that they say that for a while she worked as a cook slash nurse, which is very possible. And then at the end it says Carl first died in 1947. How can he have died in 1947 if he was meant to have died in the early 1940s on the south coast? So this was a witness statement from someone who said that they definitely knew Ruth and Carl, but yet there's no details to kind of back this up at all. So this is kind of the problem with witness statements, is that you can't take them too directly. You have to kind of take everything with a pinch of salt. Even like as I said before, with like ancestry.com, things like that, you go through it and people go, oh, this person is definitely this person, but census records are only as good as the person giving them and the person receiving them. It's like you would in most days, like the last census form that we had in 2011, it turns up and there's a big form and basically it says fill in your name and your date and date of birth and what job you do, and you handwrite it in there. Or yeah, it was handwritten last time, I think. And it's like, but that document is only as good as the person who's writing it and the person who's translating it at the other end. It could be wrong. How many times do we get our own details wrong, or how many times do we fabricate it? I remember a mate of mine on his wedding certificate. It said occupation. And now he's a very, very successful kind of creative director and owner of a company, and he does, you know, he directs a lot of stuff, and that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to be a director, but at that time he was working as an administrator in a kind of an old people's home, and he was like, what do I write? Do I write filmmaker? And I was like, yeah, sort it, do it, you know, you will be a filmmaker one day, so do it. And he was like, oh, I can't do it. So he wrote down administrator, and it's like, oh, so for the rest of his life on his wedding certificate it will say administrator. Oh, so, but that happens, doesn't it? So sometimes people change details to kind of help themselves. I thought I'd do a little bit here. Right, yes, I thought I'd do a bit here. I thought this was quite interesting. So obviously, as I've gone through here, what I've tried to do is to get John Reginald Christie's quotes from, because he gave loads of statements and they're all inaccurate and they're all quite vague. So what I've done, as I've said, is always to make them clear for you, is to kind of to cut and paste them together and dramatise them slightly, but keeping them in the real spirit and the tone. Some of the quotes you've heard in there are direct, they're verbatim, I haven't changed them. I literally have maybe put some punctuation in it just to give it a bit of rhythm. But some of them I've kind of dramatised them just slightly, but they're all still within the spirit of John Christie and in his voice and in his style. I've spent a long time trying to find his style and his rhythm. But I thought I might read you this. This is just a sample of one of the statements he gave, just after he was arrested. Spoilers. Yeah, we all know he got arrested anyway. It's kind of not really a spoiler, really, is it? I'm going to read that to you now, if I may. I'm not going to read it in his voice. I'm just going to go straight in. Even he gets details wrong here. So, a statement of 5th of June 1953, he said, when I was in the police war reserve, which was when he was a special constable, I met an Austrian girl in a snack bar at the junction of Lancaster Road and Ladbroke Grove. In one of his other statements, he says, Latimer Road and Ladbroke Grove, which doesn't have an intersection. See, that's the benefit of what I do, is when I read things, I don't take it as verbatim. I sit down and I go, where's the intersection? Oh, there is no intersection. Right. But there is an intersection between Lancaster Road and Ladbroke Grove. I was off duty at the time. This is Christie again. And I used to go to the snack bar to see if I could find a man who was wanted for theft. It was the summer of 1943. I was living in the ground floor flat of 10 Rillington Place and my wife was away in Sheffield. The Austrian girl told me she used to go out with an American soldier and one of them was responsible for the baby she had had previously. Not true, as we know, because it was the Greek Cypriot man. Although her lodger lady, who she stayed with in Golders Green, what's her name, Elsie Bessie Willis, said that she was back and forth all the time and always going out. Although what she was doing, because she was quite insular and shy, we don't know. Maybe she had got a boyfriend around that point. I got friendly with her and we went to 10 Rillington Place. And she went to 10 Rillington Place with me two or three times. This is how vague he is with stuff. One day, when this Austrian girl was with me in the flat at 10 Rillington Place, she undressed and wanted me to have intercourse with her. I got a telegram whilst I was there saying my wife was on her way home. The girl wanted us to team up together and go away together somewhere. I would not do that. I got on the bed and had sex with her. You see how vague it is. It's like in many of his other statements, he's quite direct. And he's. And there are some details about him where sometimes, I'm trying not to give away too much because he. There's a lot of contradictions with him as well. Like he'll say one thing, but he'll do the entire opposite. Like he pretends, he gets very affronted by people if they suggest that he's doing a certain thing. And like he'll be very kind of officious in the way he talks. But on the same side, he's got the various two sides to his whole personality. Whilst I was having intercourse with her, I strangled her with a piece of rope. I'll make a caveat here. Two statements he gave, one of them said he strangled her with a pair of stockings. But another one, he said he strangled her with a piece of rope. Now, because we can't prove what way he was strangled, for the sake of the narrative, I'm using the rope, because that was used in other cases as well. I'm going to keep it kind of consistent, rather than as jumping back and forth between stockings and rope. Although later on, he would also use a tie as well, just to be really annoying. I remember urine and excretia coming away from her. She was completely naked. I tried to put on some clothes back on her. She had a leopard skin coat. I wrapped this around her. I took her from the bedroom into the front room and put her under the floorboards. I had to do this because my wife was coming back. My wife came home in the evening. My brother-in-law, Mr. Waddington, as Henry, came in. Mr. Waddington went back the next day, and during the afternoon, my wife went out. I think she was working at Osram's. I think that may have been my note there. While she was out, I pulled the body up from under the floorboards and took it to the outhouse. This is the wash house out back with the... which is quite brave, really, because this is kind of daytime. And other tenants in the flat, like just above him is Mr. Kitchener on the first floor. And there's two other tenants on the second floor as well. And this is daytime. He pulls the body out of the front room, into the communal hallway, into his kitchen and out into the back garden. Now, what a lot of residents have said is that he would often, because the back garden was his, and he was like, well, I'm ground floor flat, I've got tenancy here, therefore it's my garden, you don't have access to use it. What he would do was lock the door. And quite often people would, if they need to use the loo, they would have to ask for his key to open the back door to go into the back garden to use the toilet. Or given the fact that the outdoor toilet stunk to high heaven, a lot of people didn't. A lot of people didn't use it. They'd go elsewhere to use the toilet. Little side note there. While she was out, I pulled the body up from under the floorboards and took it to the outhouse. Later in the day, I dug a hole in the garden, and in the evening, when it was dark, about 10 o'clock, I put the body down in the hole and covered it quickly with earth. It was the right-hand side of the garden, about halfway along towards the rockery. My wife never knew. I told her I was going to the lavatory. The only lavatory is in the yard. I burnt all the clothing in the garden. The next day I straightened the garden and raked it over. And that was a Christie statement, but don't forget that is Christie saying something to a policeman and the policeman translating it by writing it down. So it's not in a lot of Christie dialect. But the great thing was there was a lot of court transcripts I used. And in the court transcripts, because they have to be accurate, they're quite detailed about the verbatim. So, like, the way Christie would say things like, I don't recall, or I can't recollect, or I can't remember some of the phrases that he would use. But there are many phrases that he'd use which are very, very typically Christie. So I try to appropriate as many of them as possible. So, I think that's it. Was that good? Did you enjoy that? God, that was tiring. So, we're going to be back next week with part two. Oh, I'm having a stretch. Oh, that was good. Part two of 10 Rillington Place, which I need to sit down and start writing. That one should be interesting as well. Slowly over time, we'll learn more about Christie as we go through, and we'll learn more about his victims and his family and, you know, what's going on in his head, but it'll be a kind of a slow reveal. But yeah, I'm looking forward to these episodes. I think part one was, I enjoyed that was good fun. I think the rest of them will be good as well. So that was the end of Extra Mile. Hope you enjoyed it. I'm gonna move the boat and get a cake. Great, love to you all, speak to you soon, tatty bye bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.